This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
We play on. Shakhtar Donetsk have not played in their home stadium since 2014. Their match days now typically have no crowds, air raid sirens interrupt games, and thoughts of and fears for family, friends, and hometown's frontline troops loom large in the players' mind. These are extraordinary times, but Shakhtar is an extraordinary club. It is the subject of a brilliant new book called We Play On. It's written by Andy Brassel. Delighted to say that Andy joins us live on the line this morning. Andy, good morning to you.
Good morning, Charles. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And yourself?
Yeah, good.
Good. In a world where we are surrounded by, you can't move for footballers crashing their £500,000 Rolls Royces everywhere, it's somewhat sobering, isn't it, to look at the story of Shakhtar Donetsk and the way that you can argue that football exists in a bubble, but blimey, football in the case of this team has been, you know, being brought sharply into relief.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I think over the last 9 years, Shakhtar's players have had to cope with real life, not just as more than we would expect of your average footballer, but more than one would expect of an average person, really. And it is important to say it's 9 years, not just since 24th of February 2022, when the full-scale invasion of Russia, of Ukraine by Russia started. But it goes back before that. You know, you ask anyone connected with the club and they will say they've been under attack and their state has been at war since May 2014, when they had to leave Donetsk pretty much overnight in the east of the country, in the Donbass region, because they were invaded by Russia then. And ever since, as you say, they've been on the road, essentially living out of a suitcase. And, you know, a lot of these well-played, privileged footballers have been in a situation where they've just had to leave houses. You know, they've walked out of their home, they've left their stuff, their kids' stuff, shirts in the wardrobe, cars in the driveway, and had to start all over again.
And I mean, yeah, exactly, because it's important to say that, you know, because of where the club is based geography-wise, you know, they have been under attack since, you know, Russian separatists in that region, isn't it? And that's had a real effect on the mentality of the team.
Yeah, it has. And for the first couple of years, it was pretty tough for them. They had a very experienced coach at the time, the Romanian Mircea Lucescu, who had a huge effect on the way they caught the imagination in Europe. Anyone who saw Shakhtar play, I think, in that spell between 2017 and 2014 would have been struck by their very particular brand of football. You know, they've been referred to as the Barcelona of the East. And a team that was rising in the Champions League all of a sudden had to move to the other side of the country where they didn't have the same support network, the same fans, playing in front of tiny crowds all of a sudden, many of whom were quite hostile to them. It's a huge adjustment. And for the first couple of years, it was really difficult for them to punch their weight in sporting terms. But since then, if you count the whole time since they left Donbass and the Donbass Arena, their super futuristic 55,000 capacity home, in May 2014. Since then, they've won 5 Ukrainian Premier League titles, 4 cups, and got to the semi-finals of European competition twice, which is really remarkable in the circumstances, particularly considering they've lost so much money, their budgets have been slashed, and they've lost some really big players along the way.
Yeah, and if you think, I mean, those with long memories, because I'm talking to you from a studio based in southern Spain, and, you know, if I nip in the car, I can be in Seville in 2.5 hours. And, of course, yeah, Shakhtar famously just narrowly were beaten by a Sevilla team that went on to win the Europa League.
Yeah, they were, and that was one of those 2 semi-final defeats. And, you know, I think at that point, Sevilla were just too good for them. I mean, Sevilla have got quite a particular place in Shakhtar history, because I think when you go back to 2007, the second UEFA Cup that Sevilla won, in the last 16 of that tournament, Shakhtar were all set to knock them out. And then Andres Palop, the goalkeeper, came and scored a header in the old Shakhtar Stadium, the Olimpiski in Donetsk, in the fourth minute of stoppage time. And they ended up Sevilla winning that game in extra time as well. So I think they've got a lot of other things to think about. But at some point, they definitely owe Sevilla one when they meet them in European competition.
And perhaps, this is perhaps the thing. So this is perhaps the remarkable thing about Shakhtar, is the fact that we can say that, football, as I said before, football can be divorced from reality. But in a way, now Shakhtar's journey, almost, you could almost call it an odyssey, has come to symbolise so much about what is going on. And you only have to look at the outpouring of support for the Ukrainian national team when they played the England team in Poland. I mean, they were incredible scenes.
Yeah, and I think you're right there, Giles. They've come to represent something else, not just the Ukrainian national football team, but Shakhtar have almost become a de facto Ukrainian national team, because they are playing in the Champions League, and they've been playing in the Champions League since the start of the full-scale invasion. So they played their games, obviously not allowed to play their home games in Ukraine by UEFA. They played in Poland last season for their home games in Warsaw, and this season they're playing the home games in Hamburg. And the sense is that there's such a hunger from the public to show their support that they believe they could do it on an even bigger scale this season. I was speaking to someone at the club, and they're playing in front of 30,000 fans in Warsaw last season for their first home game in the Champions League this season, and last week against Porto they played in front of 45,000 in Hamburg. So the support is there, the desire to see Shakhtar is still there. And I think in terms of how Ukraine feels about them, it's different as well. They've almost become Shakhtar rather than Shakhtar Donetsk, not just because they've been out of Donetsk for so long and you can't see a point where they're going to get back there, not at the moment, unfortunately, at the very least, even if it remains a dream of everyone at the club. But especially since the full-scale invasion, and they've lost all the overseas players, it's a very young team of mostly Ukrainians. I think you talked before about the feeling sometimes from wider society of footballers are divorced from reality. I think in contrast, a lot of Ukrainians have felt closer to Shakhtar since the full-scale invasion, because it's this set of young Ukrainians who are very, very relatable, who they feel are really representing not just Shakhtar, but them as a country.
Here's the thought, just because my knowledge of Ukrainian is very limited indeed. Is Shakhtar, does that mean something? Because Donetsk obviously is the town.
Means minor.
Minor?
It means minor, because Shakhtar, Donetsk is a mining city, and it's always been a mining city. I mean, when they built the Donbass Arena, this incredible arena, they built it in the park in Donetsk, and it really regenerated the city, which had been thought of as quite an unattractive industrial city, a bit like maybe somewhere in northwest Germany or something like that.
Yeah.
But of course, it had a very proud tradition. It also made the build really complicated because there were pit holes everywhere. So it took even longer to put together. But, that was Rina Akhmatov, the owner, the commitment that he's shown to building that and to showcasing Donetsk and the Donbass region and their culture and his culture is the same passion that they show to keep the club going nowadays.
And this invasion, this war, has affected everybody. I mean, has affected everybody in the Ukraine, has affected people, people further afield. One of my good friends is always a cameraman. He was killed in Ukraine in the first weeks of the war. So, it has a knock-on effect for everybody. And so, that's for me was, a shock and a divorce, but, I didn't sort of expect that because he was just on a job. However, for these guys, they've got family, they've got friends, they know the area. They've been, like you said, this has been a trouble spot since 2014. So you've got to ask yourself how the players, how the coaching staff, how the management team can get on with the job. Because I remember reading Andriy Shevchenko, he was interviewed, I think it was in The Guardian or The Times or something, or might have been The Mail, and he was saying about how, you know, he really couldn't concentrate. It was a big double-page splash saying how he couldn't, you know, he was just appalled by what was going on. There were friends who had died, and this is an ex-international, a talisman for the Ukrainian national team. And you just wonder how on earth you can... In one way, how on earth you can train and play when this is happening and you're losing, you know, family, friends, you're losing. And yet at the same time, perhaps it is that thing of they can actually shut everything out and just concentrate on the football and the training.
Yeah, I think that's part of it, definitely. I think there's definitely that sense amongst the players, and I've spoken to the players extensively for the book, that they feel they're lucky. Because I think it's easier for us to look at it and say, well, actually, you know, they're footballers, they're not soldiers, but they are living a sort of military life to an extent, because most of the players, their families no longer live in Ukraine because it's not safe. So their families live in Spain or Portugal or Poland or London or wherever else. And they maybe see them once every 6 weeks, which is incredibly tough. You know, they're living this sort of subsistence life because they feel it's important. They have to work for a living, and of course they have to represent their nation at the same time. So there's something very symbolic about it. But on the other hand, that they are aware of that. They are aware of that responsibility to show that Ukraine is carrying on. But it's tough because, you know, if you knew you were doing it for one season or for two seasons in an empty stadium without your family there, that would be one thing. But knowing that, you know, when is the end, or not knowing when the end is, that's something that's something else in entirely. And, you know, these guys just show incredible fortitude to carry on, not just chasing the dreams that they had when they were kids of making it as pro footballers and representing a local club, but in terms of being able to stand up for something bigger and represent something bigger.
What's your relationship then with Shakhtar Donetsk? Because, you know, it's a team, it's a well-known team, but perhaps no more so than, say, Red Star Belgrade or any of the other teams. Why your relationship with this particular team?
Well, I started to cross them quite a lot through work in about 2007, 2008, because at the time they had a lot of Brazilian players, which was partly due to the owner, Akhmetov, and his vision of how to play football, partly because of Michel Lucescu, the then coach, who spoke Portuguese and was very into Brazilian football and still is. And speaking Portuguese, it helped me to get to know some of the players, to get close to the club, to figure out what their motivations were. And then about a year after they moved out of Donetsk, I went and did a film out there for the Guardian on how they were coping away from home. Of course, having, like them, absolutely no idea how long this would last, and not knowing at that point that it would lead to a full-scale invasion by Russia, although that was always feared, I think, in the back of people's minds. So I felt sometimes you want to write a book, but in this case, I really felt genuinely compelled to write the book. So as well as being fairly well placed because I knew the club and knew the people a little bit, it was the fact that I felt, and I still feel really passionately, that this is a story that needs to be told, that needs to be heard. And as you said before, you know, we have a particular vision often of footballers as super privileged and detached from reality. Whereas I think that the war of the last 9 years, it is the war of the last 9 years, has shown to everyone that, you know, there are some things that money and fame and status and achievement cannot protect you from. You know, the sporting director, Darius Serna, who does the foreword to the book, who is arguably the most famous player in Shakhtar's history, until Luka Modric surpassed him relatively recently, was the record cap holder for the Croatian national team. He was one of those guys who left everything behind. He said, you know, my wife's clothes and my clothes and my kids' things are still in our house. And our house, from what I hear, is still there. We can't imagine ever going back to it. You know, he just, in an afternoon, he walked out of it, left everything behind, and and never went back. And for someone like him as well, who experienced war in the former Yugoslavia when he was 7 or 8 years old, I mean, he said to me that most of the time he feels he can cope with it because he's like a dad. He's an organizer. He wants to look after the players. And he wanted to look after the players when he was helping those Brazilians in 2022 escape from Kyiv when it was under attack. But he said to me that when he hears the air raid sirens, it just takes him back to being a little kid. And that is before the money and the status or any of that.
And when you speak to the players, because it must be also for a player, you know, you're a young man, you're fit, you're in the best physical shape you're going to be, and there's a war going on, and there's a war been going on, and part of you that must say, oh well, you know, I'm glad I'm not in the war, but there's another part of you saying, listen, you know, my schoolmates, my friends are fighting, they're on the front, some of them have no doubt been injured, but it doesn't have to be schoolmates because this is a war where you're seeing indiscriminate shelling and bombing and missile attacks on you know, everywhere is the front line basically. So for them, it must be quite a difficult thing to balance between wanting, because the Ukrainian boxer had to be, you know, literally saying, look, I know you want to go and fight the Russians, but you're going to do more good fighting on the global stage boxing than you are, you know, in a trench somewhere. Did they have that same, you know, that awful thing about, okay, I know I'm doing great by doing football, but really, is it going to be, you know, would I not be doing morally? Do I want to go out there and be with my mates, be with my comrades? Because it's the most important thing that's in us to fight for one's country.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely part of that, especially with some of the younger players. And I think the fact that the way the modern world is, you can't escape from it any of the time. We talked about maybe putting it out of your mind while you're training or you're playing, but it's never that far away. I think, remember when they played Real Madrid in the Champions League about 11 months ago in Warsaw, a game in which Shakhtar nearly won. You know, they conceded an equaliser to Antonio Rudiger deep, deep, deep into stoppage time. And in the days before that, it was a point at which there was a Russian counterattack. There was heavy shelling of Kyiv and Kherson, which has been razed, as we've seen in news pictures and footage over the last year or so. And at that point, you know, there were a lot of people worried about their friends and their families. And so they're just preparing to play Real Madrid, the European champions back then. And they're just, these young guys are hunched over their phones, like looking at the news that never stops. You know, there is no way of divorcing yourself from that news. And it's not just about turning off your television, but because it's on your phone, it's following you everywhere. It's following you when you're having lunch, when you're relaxing in your room, like between a training session and a match or something like that. You know, it's not something that these young men can ever really get away from. So I'm sure they're thinking about that all the time, but it has been impressed on them as well what a job they're doing in terms of profiling Ukraine. And they're doing that all over again by taking the word and taking what they're doing from, in a Champions League sense, taking it from Poland to Germany this season.
Is there a, because I know a lot of the sort of European clubs have a song, is there an anthem, is there a hymn they sing?
No, not really.
No, I just imagine that would be an incredibly, you know, incredibly emotional moment. I mean, it's bad enough when they walk on. I should imagine that at any time, but if they had a song, you know, if they had a hymn, as they call it, an anthem, it'd be something.
Yeah, I mean, the closest I saw, really, was something visual in Warsaw last year, and I think it was for the Real Madrid match, where you had, you know, where you have a TIFO where everyone lifts a bit of cardboard and it makes a big picture across the stand. So you had one of those in the Legia Stadium at Warsaw ahead of kickoff against Real Madrid, and it was half Ukrainian flag, half Polish flag joined together, symbolising the union between the countries. And, you know, everyone I've spoken to from Ukraine and in Ukraine is incredibly grateful for the way in which Poland has received them and offered them friendship and support over the last year and a half in particular.
And perhaps that's the thing we should take out of this, because, you know, in the desperate situation that Ukraine found itself, And those first 48 hours, and we saw those convoys of Russian vehicles. We thought we were going to go steaming into Kyiv, not knowing they hadn't got any petrol in them. It's, you know, it's the flip side. They're seeing the worst, the absolute worst of humanity, and yet on the positive side, you're seeing the best of humanity in the way that they are received, and they are, and the, you know, I mean, if I'm sure if a Ukrainian team was to rock up and play anywhere in Spain in the next couple, everybody would go and see them as an act of solidarity with what they're going through.
Yeah, I think they would, but in terms of Shakhtar representing something else and being able to showcase the best of humanity, I think the club would say that they've been doing that since 2014, because it really changed Donetsk overnight, the invasion, and especially after the battle, the first battle of Donetsk airport, which was really symbolic as well as really violent, because in a day and a half, this thing that represented all the progress that the city and the region had made, this super futuristic airport, was just destroyed in that time. And there's been no flights into there ever since in the last 9 years. And, you know, at the time you had the Donbass Arena that we talked about before, that was only, what, 5 years old, just a little less than 5 years old, you know, a world-class stadium that Beyonce had opened with a concert. You had an international school that had opened, you know, a place that was considered a bit foreboding and just an industrial place right on the edge of Ukraine near Russia, had started to open its arms to Europe. And that was flattened in a day, a little bit more. And so since then, I mean, obviously a lot of people moved out. Shakhtar and their players and their staff are among the lucky ones because they're able to move out. Now, as Sergei Palkin, the CEO, put it, some of those people there, for family reasons or the elderly, they weren't able to go. And they were stuck there with a tanked economy, shops that weren't open or didn't have any supplies, no jobs, and, you know, they were left without anything. And so for the first year and a half, 2 years, you had Shakhtar mobilizing, using the Donbass Arena as a sort of food and sanitary supplies distribution center, making sure people were looked after. Rina Akhmatov has spent a lot of his own money in trying to support people in the region and maintain that link with the region. And then one day the Russians just said, no, you can't do that anymore. You can't go through our blockade. And, you know, who knows what's become of those people? You know, they've just been cut off from the aid that they were given. So it is something that not just they've done in the last year and a half to reach out and help people, and they have done enormous things to help the war injured and the war orphans through their through Shakhtar Social, which is their I suppose corporate responsibility charity arm. But it's something that they've been doing for the best part of a decade.
How difficult was this book for you to write, in terms of, you know, because you said you've followed this team since 2014? Mm. Because it must be very difficult to write a book that is informative, gets the emotion across, but isn't, if you like, sentimental, which is kind of maybe the wrong word to use, but you see what I'm going for here.
No, I know what you mean, Giles, totally. And I think you have to be guided by the story of the people that you're telling, really, and their attitudes, because it's not really my story. It's theirs. It's those players. It's those people who work for the club. It's their story and everything that they've been through. And I think there were two things really that made me think of, like, how you can place yourself when you're writing something like this. Firstly, before that Real Madrid game that we were talking about, that you could speak to the players and go, how difficult was it to play? And they look at it and say, well, we're footballers. Why would we not play? You know, it's difficult, but life is difficult. You just have to do it. You just have to get on with it. And another thing that really stuck in my mind is when someone from Ukraine connected with the club was showing me some pictures and videos from their street from the 24th of February last year when Russia originally invaded. And they're showing me some pictures on their phone, you know, they've got pictures of their kids and their dog and all that sort of stuff. And then it switches to the 24th of February and you've got one half of their street just outside Kiev totally destroyed. And you've got pictures of people in their cars who've been shot by Russian troops. And you're sitting there thinking, this is absolutely horrifying. But for me, it's just unpleasant and upsetting. For them, it's their life. It's something that's happening at the end of their road. And that is something absolutely unimaginable and thankfully unimaginable to most of us in our daily lives. So I think to bring balance, to bring clarity to that as a storyteller is an absolute privilege, and you realize that you're doing something actually that's pretty important. I mean, I've written hundreds, if not thousands of articles about football over the last 20 years. I've never felt that I'm writing something as important as this that's going to have as much resonance.
The book is called We Play On. It's by Shakhtar Donetsk, Fight for Ukraine, Football and Freedom. It's by Andy Brassel, who's speaking to today. Andy, if people want to follow you, I know that you're quite active. As you said, you've written thousands of articles. You've also done a bit of, you also appear on our various channels as well. Where can people find you online? Where's the best place to find out what you're up to?
Well, I collate it all on Twitter at Andy Brassel or on Instagram at Andy Brassel 11. And you'll see links to my various radio, podcast and TV bits there, as well as my writing.
And the book will be available as a virtual download from our own virtual download store. The book is called We Play On, Shakhtar Donetsk, Fight for Ukraine, Football and Freedom. It's by Andy Brassel. Andy, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Likewise. Thank you, Giles.